Hello and welcome back to another episode of Tax Resolution Talk. And in this episode, I was interviewed by Jared Altman, who's an enrolled agent who also does tax resolution work. We talked about the recent Treasury Inspector General report about the IRS failure to pursue high-income non-filers. We then talked about if you are a victim of unemployment fraud, what you need to know to avoid problems down the road with your taxes. There's some things you may not be aware of which can cause you trouble when the IRS gets information from the state of Maine saying you got benefits that you didn't actually receive. So you'll want to hear it all. And with that, please enjoy this episode.
But specifically the perspective of dealing with the IRS and potentially the Maine Revenue Service as well. Those two topics today are high income earner audits. And then on the opposite side of that, kind of the tax implications potentially for people who are dealing with the fallout of my brain is not working. I have employment fraud written here.
Employment fraud.
So unemployment, yes, that's the word. The unemployment fraud kind of epidemic that I know has been happening in Maine and I suspect has been happening elsewhere as well. Basically, once everybody became eligible for these $600 booster payments and lots of people were out of work, some bottom feeders kind of sends blood in the water and processed, potentially tens of thousands of these claims with the money going to bank accounts that wasn't owned by, in a lot of cases, people who are still working, but are now, as far as the Department of Unemployment is concerned, are receiving unemployment benefits. So this is going to be a whole mess. We'll talk a little bit about what people can do to prepare for that if they're a victim of this. But first, we're going to talk about high income earners and audits with Jim. Jim, you mentioned that you had read a report recently that talked a little bit about a change in stance as far as where the IRS might be going sometime, or was so much that they were being pushed towards a change of stance.
And it felt
that this is probably coming sooner or later, even if they're a little resistant to it.
Yes. What happened is the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, shorthand is TIGTA, they audit the IRS among other government agencies. And what they found is that, and this is casting faint praise, that while the IRS has not been great about non-filers in the past, they have this wonderful strategic plan, but they haven't implemented it yet. And so what TIGTA found is, and these numbers are a bit staggering, that the IRS from tax years 2014 through 16, that the IRS had identified 880,000 roughly high income non-filers. And by high income, those are people who have estimated average gross income of over $100,000 a year. And they said that roughly $45.7 billion is the estimated loss to the Treasury by these cases. So what they're saying is, great job. You're being very strategic. You've identified these people, but you're not working them. Because they found that, of those 870, plus, thousand people, the IRS didn't work about 370,000 of them. And that's about $20.8 billion they estimated. And about, 300,000 weren't placed in inventory. When you say inventory with the IRS, you mean place them in to be worked by a revenue officer or by the automated collection system. 42,000 of them were closed out and never worked. And then the remaining 510,000 remain in inventory. And the IRS is always complaining it doesn't have the resources to work these cases. So they're sort of in a holding pattern, and the TIGTA is concerned that those are never going to get worked at all. What's funny is it's kind of, TIGTA was kind of poking the IRS bear there, because they said, look, we found 100 of these folks. They have an estimated revenue due of about $9.9 billion. And we're going to give you their names and numbers, IRS. Go get them. And the IRS says, yeah, we're going to get to it. And TIGTA, because what will happen is in the TIGTA report, they'll make a recommendation and the IRS will have a chance to respond. So in this particular piece, the IRS response says, yes, we're going to audit them all. TIGTA then has a comeback, which says, well, we don't see any plans for it. So in anyways, it sounds like there's sort of a tug of war. You know, the IRS wants to work these cases. It just doesn't have the resources. And when you're making a lot of money, it's hard to collect, because what does a rich person naturally do when they're being attacked by the IRS? They lawyer up. As a lawyer, I put that. but it's a lot harder to collect than, say, someone who is a lower wage earner who cannot afford counsel, whether it be an attorney, a CPA, or an enrolled agent. It's a lot easier to collect from them. And so IRS naturally gravitates towards the easy money. So we will see. The IRS has been doing some compliance work. They had come out with a command to all of the revenue officers. And revenue officers are the on-the-ground, in-person collection agents for the IRS. They are the people that knock on the door and ask for money. They were tasked with going out and knocking on the door of every person in the state that owes over $100,000 and either owes it or hasn't filed a return where they're estimated to owe that much. Mm-hmm. With coronavirus, it's unclear if they did all of that, but that was the plan. So we'll see. I think what's important about this report is there is a push to get the IRS sort of focused on the big money. You know, regardless of how hard it is to collect it, get it, because it really undermines the foundation of a tax system when this tax system is only efficient and effective for those who don't have the money to protect themselves, and that the rich can kind of, you know, paying taxes for poor people, as Leona Helmsley said back in the 80s. And that's sort of my take on it. Well, I think we're going to see the IRS doing more work on these high income non-filer cases.
Yeah, and there've been some talk about the different ways that could be done. I know that they have approached a really big one recently, in the last year or two, where Caterpillar had some federal agents in there over some transfer pricing issues. And the IRS has been, I can even say from having been in the IRS building locally in the past 6 months, that, you know, I saw clearly some of the agents had been going over basis and partnership audit techniques. I literally saw the lesson up on the board. That's not something that's something that I have heard articulated in the past, that, you know, it's one of the more complicated things to audit if you're going to track basis in a partnership over time. And for a long period, you know, they weren't up on that, but it's become one of the priorities, and some of the reports that have been put out actually have said that they're looking to train agents on that to start to move into that area. And so, you know, people who, you know, have been relatively audit free just because of the nature of their entities and the complexity of their finances, you know, the IRS is starting to train people to be able to look into that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's one thing I've noticed in not just this report and several others, that the IRS had gone through a period where there was a big turnover in employees. So there was a brain drain, especially among small business and self-employed, which is the one part of the IRS that has the most impact on taxpayers. And, you know, and if you're going to be engaging in bad behavior with taxes, it's usually going to be through complicated things like partnerships, S-corps, sort of, you know, putting money from one entity to another, moving it around, that sort of financial chicanery, as I would say. And the IRS just hasn't been able to keep up with it. They just didn't understand it, grasp it. And so it was easier just to find a couple things and close the audit out. And so a lot of these richer people were just like, oh, hey, this is great. Just make it complicated. The IRS will find a couple things to look good and move on. So we'll see. I'm glad that they're doing it, not because I want them particularly to target my clients, but, you know, when it comes to a fair tax system, you want everybody to be treated the same. And so if you're sort of breaking the rules, you want people to deal with it. You know, if you're doing what's right, you should only pay what you should pay. And that's nothing more than that. And let's see, is there anything more to say about that?
No, I think that's the big thing, is just people should be prepared for more. And it might be a year, it might be 2 years with the IRS's pace, it might be 5 years before this really gets into swing. But it is coming, and they, you know, they do look back. And I know that the example of this that I can see, I know in the, I believe it was in the Southeast for a big chunk of the last decade, you know, the IRS did a sweep of, you know, single member professional services S-corps. There are a lot of financial planners and lawyers and things like that that were caught up in that, where they were addressing reasonable comp. So, you know, that's a relatively simple one to do. You could just look and say, you know, did you take any wages? No. Well, we know you're not right on that. But this is getting into a little bit more complicated stuff. And I think that people who have been savvy in the past just need to be aware that the administrative posture of the IRS may be getting a little more aggressive with their tax planning. So they really need to pay attention to it and make sure they're consulting people to be compliant with the current case law.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing is high income is only $100,000 or more. So,
yeah,
you know, if you're thinking I'm not a millionaire, I don't need to worry about it. If you're making good money and it's, you know, it's not hard even in Maine to two professional professionals married can make easily over $100,000. So something to always consider.
We will see. And I was going to say, that's one of those unfortunate kind of middle grounds too, where professional service fees can really take a bite out of your available cash, and you're no longer eligible for some of the low income tax clinic services. You know, if you get over $200,000 or $300,000, you know, paying a bill isn't as hard, but you know, $100,000 can get eaten up in a mortgage and kids real quick. So it's in some ways it's almost a more dangerous middle ground, because you don't have as much leeway and you don't have access to the services that people making slightly less would.
Yeah. Yeah, I will definitely agree with that. I've had a bunch of quote unquote rich couples, high income couples file bankruptcy, and it's amazing when you look at what they're spending money on. You're not ridiculous about what they're spending, and they don't have much left over, even with you know, a good earning. So
yeah. But I think that's enough for that. The second thing that we were gonna talk about was the unemployment fraud. So there's been a rash of unemployment fraud throughout Maine, and I haven't confirmed it, but I suspect that since this isn't necessarily, it hasn't been identified as a local problem, in the sense that it's being perpetrated mostly by people in the state, I suspect this is happening all over the country. Although again, I haven't confirmed it outside of Maine. Basically, what we said was that people have been filing false unemployment claims and having that money routed to bank accounts, or in some cases it might go to just the Reliant prepaid debit card that some people have been getting. So it's even easier that it just gets cashed out and swiped, and you know, people walk away with what it is, and there isn't actually a bank trail other than the mailing address that it went to, which makes it really hard to track stuff down. Or it's Reliant card, it's US Bank, it's some bank. I saw one
of my it's Reliant card. Yep.
And so the issue there, if the Department of Labor gets this all, I guess it's technically a department, it's re-employment in our case, if they get all of this straightened out by tax time next year, hopefully they'll have figured out who was fraudulent and who wasn't. At which point, if they figure it out, it was a fraudulent claim, then, you know, they won't issue any income reporting documents to that taxpayer. That would be my assumption of what they would do. However, if they don't get it all worked out, or someone doesn't know that it happened, you know, they're going to get a income reporting document that says that they got all this unemployment, and at $4,000 a month for 8 or 9, maybe 10 months, you know, that's $40,000 in additional income. Most likely even put the kind of minimum wage worker probably somewhere either on the edge of no longer being in the bottom tax bracket to being in the tax bracket above it. For other people, it might solidly bump them up. They're going to owe somewhere between probably 10 and 30% on those earnings. You know, you kind of do the math on that in your head. You know, that could be...
It's going to be more than a pump change. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it could be anywhere from, you know, $4,000 to $20,000 plus penalties and interest if you don't find out about it for a year or two. You know, there could be some people getting $50,000 to $100,000 tax bills based on this over the next couple of years, especially if they weren't aware of it. And so one of the key things is if, you know, you are worried about this or you think you might be affected because maybe some of your coworkers are, even though you haven't heard anything, is just to get your documentation ready. Because the unfortunate reality is if those reporting documents go out, the IRS, as far as the kind of case law that goes into this, has been ruled on over more or less the past century. So this isn't a new thing. They've met their burden of proof that you have the income. They've gotten the document. And it's, generally speaking, not an easy task to prove to the IRS that you didn't have the income that someone else received a document, that someone else sent a document for, because, you know, they're like, well, then why did they send the document? And, you know, if we just accepted that everybody who got a document and then came to us and said that they didn't really, you know, where would we be? It's you're really in an uphill battle in that kind of situation. And it's, unless there's some special administrative procedure for dealing with this, it's not going to be an easy task unless they come up again with something specifically to deal with this. And I don't think they'll move fast enough for that, but there's the potential that they might. There isn't a straight route to get there as of yet for how you improve this. But generally speaking, kind of the ways that, you know, you could make your case that it wasn't would be to show that you were in fact employed. Because if you were in fact employed, unless you're committing unemployment fraud yourself, you're probably not drawing unemployment. So, you know, one of the things that I've talked to a few people about when they've discussed this with me is, you know, keeping copies of your pay stubs, you know, for the period when coronavirus started through when unemployment for that would have ended, which would be towards probably the end of this year. It could be an electronic copy. Keep an electronic copy of every pay stub. You know, most employers, you can download that online or, you know, stick it in an envelope and create a photocopy of it. If you still get a paper stub, have all those to show that, you know, you were employed. You know, that adds to the credibility of your statement that this was fraud and you weren't drawing unemployment. And it's important to collect that stuff now because your employer may not have it still in their records 3 years from now. Some employers do, but not everyone is going to, are going to be able to give you that detail. And if you can't get it then, you know, you miss out on that one element that could have helped you a little bit. And we're going to go over a bunch of elements, but again, you want to get these now because you may not be able to get them later.
Yeah, definitely don't want to wait because the IRS moves very, very slowly on these cases. What happens is that the IRS has what they call the automatic underreporter. And it'll go through returns and compare what's on the return to information returns, like a W-2 or 1099, that's been reported to it. And if it sees a discrepancy, it'll send out a notice saying, hey, here's this notice. And they oftentimes don't come until a year or two down the road. And they never come at a good time. From my experience with clients who come in with what they call CP2000 notices, never comes at a good time. But if you don't have your stuff together, then you're going to be a real pickle.
Yeah. And the next thing I would say to start keeping it, again, just from dealing with banks, you know, it's the same situation. You want to get it now because it may not be available later, is, you know, having your bank statements for all 12 months of 2020. You can still get those now. You may not be able to get them in a year. And showing that you know, you don't have these deposits of $1,000 a week from unemployment. You know, there's always the possibility that, you know, you could have that debit card, or you could have done it with another bank, but the IRS can search for your accounts, you know, in that kind of situation. There's a reason why there's a social security number attached to every bank account that you get nowadays. The Know Your Customers laws give the federal government the ability to figure that stuff out. But again, it's not going to prove it on its own, but you're doing your best to establish for whoever's reviewing this that it's what you're saying is reasonable, and all the things that they can look at match your story. So again, you know, 12 months of bank statements showing, you know, also that, you know, you got your paychecks from your employer. There aren't any unemployment amounts being deposited. And, you know, all your expenses are looking the same, because that's not one that I've mentioned before. But, you know, if all your expenses, your income looks the same and your expenses look the same and all your bills are still being paid out of your wages, what the heck are you using those unemployment funds for that you supposedly got?
Yeah, that's a good point. Is most criminals, when it comes to financial criminals, you know, they're not the kind of people who go and take and bury their loot out in the desert and wait 10 years. Oftentimes, they start showing a higher standard of living than what their reported income suggests. So, you know, if your expense is the same, your income appears to be the same, certainly it looks more in your favor.
Yeah, and that's the big thing too, is that, you know, like I was saying, if you have this free cash on a card, you know, people are probably going to, you know, would be swiping groceries with it or swiping for purchases. But again, if you're seeing consistent spending habits, you're literally only, you know, again, it's one more piece of the fact pattern that kind of shows that you'd have to be trying really hard to hide this unemployment in very specific ways, because everything is looking the same. Yeah. Another thing that we talked about was a sworn statement in front of a notary public, or perhaps in front of a lawyer, or someone of that nature. You know, notary publics are pretty easy. There's some language, and we can, I know I'm going to put together some language based on some under reporter audits that I've been in, where we've submitted a, you know, a sworn statement as part of proving something. The IRS tends to take people more seriously if they're willing to sign a, you know, a sworn statement in front of someone. They're kind of the general belief that, while some people lie, they're less likely to affirmatively lie, especially, you know, if it says under penalty of perjury, because most people understand that that's a big deal, even if they're not particularly familiar with the law. You know, they get that perjuring yourself is not a good thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put together a statement of what that would look like. And if this does come up for someone before then, I can obviously talk about, you know, what that would look like proactively. But again, most of this stuff is going to happen potentially over the next, probably the next 12 to 24 months.
Yeah.
I
might throw in that, hey, if you, like my sister-in-law, she found out she was a victim of the unemployment fraud because they said, hey, you're receiving these benefits, and she's still working full time at a bank. There was no need for her to furloughed or anything. You know, in that case, if you know immediately that someone has, you know, used your name to get unemployment benefits, you want to do something immediately. I'm not exactly sure. If you're a victim of financial fraud, you'd go to the police. They can't do anything, but you would at least go and do a police report, and then they would run up the food chain. You might even contact the Maine Attorney General or the Maine Department of Labor, putting something on the record that, hey, I didn't take the, you know, I didn't get this money, so that you can get some correspondence from the Department of Labor or from other agencies saying, oh, we've got your report. Yeah, we know it's unemployment fraud. So if the state doesn't fix the problem by the time taxes are due, at least you've got another piece of the puzzle to show the IRS, hey, look, this is not my money.
Because
usually what I get from people who have a similar, arguably a similar situation is someone went out, used my social security number to set up a PayPal account and ran a business through it. And so they'll get a 1099 saying, hey, there's all these, you know, merchant sales. And now they're saying it's my income. But it was my boyfriend who used my social security for convenience or similar things like that. You know, that's very, very hard to fight off, you know, because, you know, unlike this case where maybe you can set up the set the stage where you can show that you didn't, but something where there's no records, it's very hard to fight off the appearance that, yeah, that was really your money. And now you've been caught. Hopefully that made sense. I guess what I'm saying is you can't do as much as you can to feather your nest so that when it comes time, you can show, look, this is not something that's my income.
Yeah, and that's a great example. It's a similar thing to what I was talking about with, you know, setting up the notary public or setting something up with a notary public where you sign something. And it's, again, just people who have been the victims of financial fraud generally do report them. If they can, if you've had something stolen from them, these are reasonable things for you to do. So, you know, when the IRS looks at you, they ask, you know, have you done the reasonable things that someone who is a victim of financial fraud or fraud would do? Filing a police report is one of them. If you don't have any records, you haven't filed any reports, you know, they look at you and they go, well, you're saying this, but why didn't you do these things? These would be reasonable things for you to do, and you've done none of them. And, you know, saying I was busy, is not an answer that's going to help you.
As a lawyer, I've seen a couple of cases where people will either file bankruptcy or they've been charged with fraud. And oftentimes they'll say, I lost something, or somebody broke into my house, my records were burnt up in a fire, a flood. And then they'll say, okay, did you file an insurance claim? Did you file a police report? No. And automatically their credibility just takes a hit. It may be true that maybe they had other things going on in their life and they didn't do it, but it doesn't look congruent with someone who has indeed lost something, fire, flood, or crime.
Yeah. And again, you know, the other side of that is, you know, in this case, the IRS is going to take a look at someone who's willing to file a police report and go, you know, where some people are willing to perpetuate kind of casual is not the right word, but kind of casual low-key fraud, and see if they can get away with it. But that kind of person is also not going to be the kind of one that wants to go file a police report and shine light on what they're doing. So that, again, that lends to your credibility that this actually happened, because the last thing that someone perpetuating fraud wants to do is have a police report about the fraud that they perpetuated. So
yeah,
that's part of why it lends credibility with the IRS. Those were the main things. Did you have any others, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the proactive approach. But let's say, you know, you, by the time you listen to this, you've already been notified that, hey, you know, you've got this unreported income. I think it's just kind of go over briefly like some of the key steps here. So typically you'll know that this is a problem for you when you'll get a notice from the IRS. It comes in two different flavors. The first one is the CP2000 notice. It's not an audit. This is, the IRS is allowed to make changes to returns based on sort of mathematical errors is how they term it. And they'll say, hey, look, we've noticed that there is this amount of reported income according to records with us, but your return doesn't reflect that. So you've got 30 days to respond, you know, agree, disagree, what have you, and deal with it.
And this is why we talked about getting the records in advance, because you don't know when this is going to happen. And if you were paying close attention to what Jim said, he said 30 days. So you have this 30-day moving deadline. It could happen at the worst time in your life with a bunch of other stuff going on. And if you've got to reconstruct your records a year and a half while you're dealing from now, a year and a half from now while you're dealing with something else big, you know, that's going to go from, oh, I can kind of collect these over the next 2 months, get them all together, put them in a file, to, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this?
Well, and it actually turns out to be 60 days, but they don't write it that way. For most people, they only think they have 30. But what will happen is if you don't respond, or if the IRS doesn't agree with the response, they'll issue you a status, they call it statutory notice of deficiency. We call it SNOD for short. And that says, look, we have made the change to return and you've got 90 days to file a petition with tax court to challenge this. Otherwise, you owe the tax. So, and again, people often don't understand, you know, the consequences of that. For them, it's like, oh, well, you know, if they assess the tax, I'll just come back around and prove it. It's not that big of a deal. But legally speaking, your opportunity to challenge your tax without paying it ends when the tax court 90-day window ends. Because the rule is that you have to pay the tax first, generally speaking, then you've got to file a claim with the IRS to refund the money, and then when the IRS denies it, then you could take it to federal district court. And for many people, if you're low income, you don't have the money to pay a lawyer to go fight this out in federal district court. So the tax court is your opportunity to challenge it in a cost-effective manner. So that 90-day window, you've got to do something about it. Now, I was going to say, I haven't heard about this myself. I've never done it. But there has been a practitioner who says that, look, if you get that 90-day letter, he'll often fax in the information to the IRS before it gets more than 30 days to that 90-day window. And he's had the IRS make the change and pull it back. So there's always an opportunity to deal with this, but doing nothing is the worst thing you could do.
Yeah. And the thing I was going to say is, you know, if you respond to that CP 2000 really timely, you know, you come and talk to someone if you're not sure what to do and you get it out within the first, you know, 10 to 15 days, or you just need a little bit of time and you have someone call up the IRS, sometimes you can get an extension before that SNOD comes out. And, you know, if you do that, your file, it makes your file look a lot more credible. You know, you didn't wait on this. They didn't have to send you a bunch of notices. They sent you a notice. You got a representative. They contacted. You said you were going to deliver the documents by this date. You deliver the documents by this date. It looks like you've been preparing for this because you knew it might happen. You know, the IRS has to follow a procedure, but, you know, they also, in the back of their mind, is also going to be compliance history and how you interact with them. You know, if the story looks like you're a very put together taxpayer who has their records in order, that's going to make you look more credible with your claim that this was fraud. And rather you just try to avoid paying, you know, what they think you owe.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting that in quick also helps.
Yeah. And this is something that, if you're not absolutely sure, you can do this. If you're like me, a little bit paranoid, the IRS allows you online access to your tax documents, your tax, they call it tax transcript or account transcripts. This allows you to see for a particular tax year what you owe and things like that. They also have a type of transcript called wage and income transcript. So for example, 2019, when the W-2s are filed, you'll find them under 2019 wage and income reporting. Now, each year comes out roughly, I think, 6 months to 9 months after the end of the tax year. So for 2020, if you either had unemployment or maybe you think, I better check this, come 2021, it'll be after you file the return if you file on time, but you can check it. And if you see that there's a unemployment that either doesn't match what you actually received or you see it and you never received any of it, that one keys you in that, hey, you'll be expecting a CP 2000 notice in your future. So that's probably a more sophisticated tactic, but if you're comfortable logging on to irs.gov and setting up your account, you can check it. Once you get it done, it's pretty easy to deal with it in the future. So just a tip for someone who is, you know, a little paranoid and wants to make sure.
And I know there's software, and I think Jim has this software in particular, and I've used it before, but for practitioners, and it costs a fair bit of money to get it, but it has the ability to kind of check and see when things pop up. So, you know, if this is something you're worried about and you want to enter an engagement with someone who does this kind of work for a living, you know, they can set it up so that it, you know, pulls your transcripts every month, and, you know, right around May of next year, you know, they can be looking at it and going, you know, do I see any do I see anything funny? And do I see any funny business on this? And then, you know, you could potentially get a call about that. But, you know, at that point, you know, you're working with a professional and you'll need to kind of figure out how that engagement is going to work with them. But that is also an opportunity for someone who just really doesn't want to deal with this or just needs the peace of mind that it's being monitored.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to our first part of this episode, which was the high income non-filers, trust me, it's a lot easier to chase after the people who've got wage and income transcripts and who don't have a lot of money. It's a simple letter. It's not even considered an audit. So the IRS is more than happy to send out letters because it collects money.
So I think that's probably everything we got for today, which is just actually the theme today has been, you know, if the IRS has notices from other people or has records of your income, even if you haven't been audited before or received correspondence, it doesn't mean that it isn't going to happen in the future. And especially with the unemployment, if those letters do go out, the IRS already has a system in place to deal with that. And if you're more complex or your taxpayer with more complex finances, they are gearing up to and being pushed towards coming after those kind of taxpayers a bit more. So just something to be aware yeah. of and to watch what you're doing and to make sure that you're compliant because, you know, saving 10,000 in tax a year is great. But if they come back and reassess that 10 for 3 years, and then add penalties and interest on it, you know, you could end up with a $60,000 or $70,000 tax bill pretty quickly.
The new IRS commissioner has said, you know, he's going to put the E back in enforcement. So at least among Jared and I, we both expect that there's going to be a lot more enforcement. So we'll see. And especially with all of the money that's being spent on coronavirus relief, the Treasury is going to be strained. And so money's going to have to come from somewhere. So this is I don't want to call it easy, but it is very hard to hide from the IRS now, you know, to be a non-filer and to fly under the radar. So the IRS knows of you if you haven't filed for a while or knows of your unreported income. It just maybe not has the money right now to get you, but some point they're coming after you.
So that's all we have for, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and thank you for putting this together. I hope we can do this again.
Yeah, and I think the next topic we had talked about, if people have any interest in it, you had mentioned there was one other, what was the other thing that we didn't talk about today?
If you're like me and you like those salacious stories, next, TIGTA also came out with a report about tax return preparers who are either not compliant with their tax filing or haven't filed returns at all. And going back to Uncle Sam has some good data gathering techniques. They know if you haven't, how much money you've been making based on some estimates. So it'll be interesting to talk about.
Yeah. So that's, we'll talk about that and probably something else that we haven't figured out next time. But if that interests you looking at that and maybe it might make sense to tack on a little bit about preparer penalties and exactly what happens when you run into a bad preparer. That would be kind of an interesting set of topics that would mesh together. So if that interests you, tune in next time.
Great. Well, thank you, Jared. And we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you later.